The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Welcome to another Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I meet French director Michel Aznavisius to discuss his Oscar contender, The Artist. And in a Michelle double bill, the Malaysian-Chinese actress Michelle Yeoh inhabits the skin of Aung San Suu Kyi in The Lady. Helping me review the week's other big release, Zan Brooks joins me to look at Daniel Craig in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Easy on the Brussels sprouts, it's Film Weekly. One of the big hits of Cannes this year is finally on our big screens. The Artist is, on the surface, a tough pitch, a black and white French silent tearjerker, an attempt at balancing a nostalgia for this early form of cinema, yet winning over a savvy CGI-primed audience. All of this the film has managed to do, and recently it picked up several Golden Globe nominations and is on a steady climb as favourite for the Best Picture at the Oscars. Its creator is French director Michel Aznavisius, who made his name in his home country with the witty Bond parodies OSS 117. I met up with Michel here in London earlier this year to discuss his surprise Oscar contender, and I put it to him that it must be a bit of a shock to see how popular The Artist has become.
You're right, the response of the audience is all over the world, but in Spain, in Canada, in the United States, here in France, where I've been, and in festival, or the people love the movie. Mm. And I feel very lucky because at the very beginning, you can imagine it was not easy and it was not done because this movie, silent black and white movie, is so out of the market. Mm. That nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted to put money in it. Mm. And the financials, they predicted me that nobody would like to see that movie, and and they were wrong. So
But you must have known, you must be very strong in yourself to know that you've got something right here. Your vision that you had, the idea with you and Jean Dujardin, Bernice Bejour, that this could work. But even you, in your biggest dreams, could not imagine that you could make it appeal to so many people. I mean, your comedies have been popular before with SOS, with Jean Dujardin, but not on such a wide scale. There's some magic that I don't even think you can predict or even know what it is that makes it so appealing.
Yeah, no, you can't predict something like that. I mean, what I was saying when we were looking for the money, I said that maybe they were right, maybe we won't do a wonderful box office, but I was not predicting, but I was selling my movie, so maybe I was lying, but the fact is I didn't lie. I said that we could do a prestige movie, a movie that could behave very well in the festival, and also a movie with no language, a universal language, that silent movie that means that we can sell it all over the world. And actually, I didn't lie. I mean, it's half luck, but I didn't lie.
No, you're proved yeah. Correct. It is extraordinary to me, and yet not extraordinary, because I've seen the film. I saw it not knowing too much about it. I knew nothing. That's the glory of Cannes, is that you don't know anything. But do explain to me the story, because when I first saw the schedule for Cannes, it was not in competition. And then Harvey Weinstein bought it before anyone saw it, and then it was in competition. And I think this is great for your movie. I think that deal kind of has sort of helped its fate. Otherwise, it could have been a lovely movie, the same movie, but not as globally seen. I think, can you tell me what happened? Did he see it and fall in love, and people suddenly realise what this was when an audience was seeing it?
Yeah, I'm not sure that Harvey Weinstein put the film in competition, actually.
No, I don't know.
No, because I think Thierry Frémaux was the head of the Cannes Festival. He's a very independent person, so I guess he took the decision. And I can't really explain. What I know is I wanted to be in competition. Mm. And I made a citation of Maradona, the soccer player, who said once that to get in the 18 yards with the balloon and not be able to shoot was like dancing with his sister. And I said to be in competition with to be out of competition is like dancing with his sister. So we wanted to be in competition. I thought it was good for the movie. And I think it was a very good way for the birth of the movie. To be born in Cannes was the perfect event for that movie, because I think it's a movie also for movie lovers.
Yeah.
I mean, if you like cinema, you'll like this movie.
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
Think.
But did you conceive it as a comedy in a way, having worked with Jean Dujardin, and now people are kind of realizing its artistic credentials, or what's very high, the magic, the sort of sadness of the story. All those magic ingredients that makes it an intellectual experience as much as an emotional experience.
No, I tried to make it. I did it in the other way. I mean, I really, first of all, I wanted to make a silent movie, a black and white silent movie. That was a formal desire, a director's desire. And then I watched a lot of movie, and I noticed that the ones who aged the better were the melodramas and the romances. So I decided to make a melodrama with absolutely no irony, no sarcasm, and no cynicism. But I love comedies, and I love entertain people. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of funny things in it, and there's a lot of like jokes. And I think it's an entertaining movie, but it's not a comedy in the way. I don't want to have maximum of love. I try to respect the characters and try to respect the story, but in an entertaining way. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I think it's delightful, and I can't wait for more people to see it here in the UK. It's just come out in France, and obviously it's been a huge success in 1 week already, which is extraordinary, because children like it as well. As I mean, everyone can like it. It's brilliant. You can sell it to Africa, India, China. They're all going to love it, really.
Yeah, actually, there's something with the format, because you don't have sound at all. I mean, there's some music, but
yeah, nice music actually.
Yeah, very nice music composed by Ludovic Bos.
Yeah, and very important, I think.
Exactly, but you don't have the voices, you don't have the lines, you don't have the sound design. So that means that the audience, the viewer, does the job. Mm. So that means that the viewer does half of the storytelling, and that makes the story very close of each of us, because we do the job. So the characters have the voice you want them to have, and they say the lines that you want them to have. So the story fits to everyone because they do the job. Yeah. So everybody can follow and like. Actually, people think it's a very intellectual thing to see a silent movie.
Yeah.
And I think it's the exact opposite.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
It's very sensual.
Yeah.
It's like painting or music.
Michel Aznavisius, congratulations on The Artist. And I wish it the best of luck on its forward journey through all the way through to the next Oscars. And where better to end a journey than in Hollywood, I think, like this with this film.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
The Artist, of course, is a must-see in a cinema near you from Friday, the 30th of December. Now, there's very little silent about Zan Brooks, who bumbles in to join me to review some of the week's other notable releases. Well, there aren't that many, really, but we should make a note of The Artist. I don't want to go too much on The Artist, Zan, because we've got our end-of-year review show coming up next week, and I'm preempting here. Yeah, well, I'm just kind of feeling it. I mean, we've been talking about the film since Cannes, basically. So it has crept up on us silently.
It's weird that it's actually finally out.
Yeah, that other people can see.
The whole thing about The Artist is that it's been a surprise from start to finish, hasn't it? It was a very last minute addition at the Cannes Film Festival. It was after the official lineup was announced, and they kind of shoehorned it in.
Yeah,
I think on the middle Saturday or Sunday, and I remember having that prejudice when it happened, of thinking, oh, this is just some some sop to kind of big budget French cinema.
We found out that Harvey Weinstein had got behind it.
Yeah, and it all smacked of this weird little compromise. And then we went to see it and were completely blown away. And now, of course, it's got up this sort of head of steam ahead of the Oscars. And yet it is a small film. So it's almost one of those things that I'm very cautious about trumpeting it so loudly.
Because it's
a discovery. It's a little miracle, I think.
So we were enchanted by it at Cannes, and that's what it does. Its spell is enchantment. And as I was talking to Michel Aznavisius about, it's very difficult to do that. I think it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. It either happens sometimes or it doesn't. But it's normally on the first viewing, love at first sight kind of thing. Has it got legs? I mean, now that you've seen it again, does it have legs? Can it enchant a second time, if you see what I mean?
I was really worried about seeing it again, because you're right. It's a film that seems born out of a happy innocence. And it's perhaps best viewed in a happy innocence, in that kind of thrill of discovery. And yet I thought it stood up beautifully the second time. It's a film that's warm, that's funny. It's big, broad emotions, because it's in that silent screen tradition where everything's slightly projected.
Yeah.
And yet there's a heart and an authenticity and an integrity to
it. But
it
knows
well.
It as well. There are very few words in it, obviously, but the ones that are on intertitles, I think we call them.
Yeah.
There's the word it uses twice is too much mugging. She says on the side of it, is there too much mugging? Well, is there too much mugging? This is a Frenchman doing silent movies. It's aware of what it's doing, and yet it's got the innocence of not being aware of it.
Yeah, it strikes that beautiful balancing act, I think, that it's honouring all of the language of silent screen cinema and yet occasionally kind of riffing on it for the modern sensibility.
Yeah.
And the way it does that, and never too much that it breaks the spell, but just enough to keep you slightly unsure where it's going.
That's The Artist, and it may feature in our end of year review show next week. But Zan, there's also something else that we've seen before out this week, and I'm talking about The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. You may have read the Stieg Larsson original. You may have seen the original movies, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, The Girl Who Lit a Fire, The Girl Who Went to Shopping and Came Back and Went to Westfield a bit, or whatever that third one was called. But now, whatever you've done, you can't miss the fact that it's back again, this time directed by David Fincher, with Daniel Craig and Rooney Mara.
Your report, very detailed. Just for me, it wasn't very entertaining.
It wasn't meant to be.
When I write about people, I try to entertain the reader.
Wennerstrom wasn't entertained much.
Your boss, Romansky, now he tells me you only do jobs that interest you, so I suppose I should be flattered. You gonna sit down? He also says that you're the one he goes to when the job is, sensitive. That's the word he used.
Sensitive.
I'm going to use illegal, because that's what it was when you hacked into my computer.
No, I'm not going to do anything about that. I could, but I won't.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a story, and if it entertains you, maybe you'll decide to help me research further. And if not, I'll do the washing up and you'll never see me again. You know, you should eat that.
What kind of research?
Elizabeth. Oh, can I call you Elizabeth? I want you to help me catch a killer of women.
David Fincher's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Is it David Fincher's? Is it Stieg Larsson's? Where are we with this? And did we need another remake? Is it any good?
Maybe we didn't need another remake, particularly, you know, 18 months after the original Swedish version that was a huge hit, that actually did have a crossover audience.
Exactly.
Is it David Fincher? I think it probably is. It struck me that this is a nice meld of Zodiac, which was his procedural thriller about the hunt for a serial killer.
Excellent film.
And Seven, which has it has the same sort of disgust for human cruelty and human brutality.
And
also,
yet,
the same palette, the same kind of greeny-grey,
you're right, and that kind of wintry Alex Cross kind of setting. But there's also a bit of Social Network in there, it seemed to me.
Yeah.
Because she's a cyber hacker.
Yeah,
and
she
so
is,
there's a lot of oh, I wish I had their computer envy in this film.
So it's tailor-made for Fincher's sensibility, and it's a film noir, but it plays out in the far north of Sweden, where everything's snow-blasted, and you have these big pale houses sitting against the pale sky, and Christopher Plummer as the wealthy old industrialist who hires Daniel Craig's disgraced journalist to investigate this 40-year mystery of his disappeared niece, and says, you're going to have to investigate the nastiest people you've ever met, my family. And there's this sense that all of these kind of wealthy Swedes are living, you know, huggle-muggle, but not actually talking to each other. And it's this cauldron of you know, just nasty, dysfunctional people.
It's weird, isn't it? Because you've got that kind of Bergman-style island that they all live on. Mm. You can only get to it by a bridge, and they're cut off. And yet they're all together in these big houses. One of them's an old kind of mansion style. Then Stellan Skarsgård lives in this kind of super flashy...
He's the new Sweden, we're told.
The new Sweden versus the old Sweden. And there's a kind of slightly bit of, like, all the snows are covering, you know, layers of anti-Semitism, years of anti-Semitism, that rears its head. It's all there. I've got to say that I thought this was really, really, really good stuff.
Yeah, I really liked
this. I really enjoyed it a lot more than the original Swedish one, which I didn't mind either. But I thought this one, I know it helped me that it was not in Swedish. And yet, also, I like the fact that people were still doing Swedish accents in all the places.
That kind of annoyed me a little bit at times. So you've got Daniel Craig just basically doing standard British accent.
He just can't.
And then you've got other characters using the slightly that kind of default European accent, occasionally saying tack, occasional weird things where some newspapers have the headline in English and other times on the website it will be a Swedish headline. Yeah. And the train stations
are in Swedish.
All of that was a little bit jarring. And yet at the same time, I think that Fincher handles the material brilliantly. It's got a remorseless, stealthy quality to it. It's not a fast film, but it absolutely has you gripped. And I thought that Daniel Craig was superb in what might normally be a thankless role of just, you know, the investigator. And Rooney Mara has obviously got the more high-voltage role as the girl with the dragon tattoo, Lisbeth Salander. And yet I thought that Craig, it's a very good, unprepossessing, but purposefully unprepossessing.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you're so used to seeing him as Bond now, even though he's not been doing it for that long. But once you're Bond, it's very hard to break out. I remember Roger Moore used to do it in the 70s. He'd pop up in other films, as long as he was slightly a man of action.
Yeah.
And this is almost... You can see that it's another shade to his Bond. If Bond was
Pierce
slightly
Brosnan
kind of more...
did a similar thing. I remember when he was in The Tailor of Panama, the John le Carré adaptation, which he was very good in, where he was playing a kind of anti-Bond and riffing very nicely off that. Craig does a similar thing here, in that he's fairly bumbling. You know, he's a bit of a kind of hapless investigator who's always falling over.
I mean, Bond would never be seen in knitwear.
He's got the knitwear, I like this a lot.
Yeah, I did too. I like the opening credits as well. I thought they were amazing.
The opening credits are, weirdly, that's like a sort of Bond movie starring Marilyn Manson, isn't it? And I guess it serves as a weird sort of overture to the themes that will be explored, but it does it, whereas the film is actually very restrained a lot of the time and occasional sort of explosions of violence, the opening credits are just wildly over the top.
Yeah, we had Noomi Rapace on the show last week talking about getting rid of Lisbeth Salander, the ghost of Lisbeth Salander that was growing in her. She's now transferred that duty over to Rooney Mara. How does Rooney Mara do? I mean, no one really knows who Rooney Mara is before this, unless they were experts in bit parts in The Social Network.
Yeah, she was. I think she bookended The Social Network, didn't she? She was the girl who jilts Mark Zuckerberg in that.
Yeah, this is what happens
scene.
To you when you get jilted by a computer genius into a kind of lesbian biker, studded hacker.
I thought that she was adequate, and that sounds like very faint praise. I think that it's a tricky role to bring off because it's supposedly it does everything that you need in the accoutrements in how she looks, in that sort of emo kind of quality that she brings to it. I thought that she was good. I think Noomi was probably better though.
Maybe. I quite liked Rooney, I thought she was. I sort of understood her a little bit more, but maybe that's because I've now seen three Noomi Rapace kind of takes on it before the first time I saw her. So I'm getting to understand Lisbeth a bit. You're right, she is a sort of a bit unknowable in this. Mm. The film does do little different things that people who I've read the book, it kind of brings in elements of the second and third film I've seen into this one and kind of pads it out a bit. I think all for the better. I don't know if there are more plans to make, you know, the rest of them.
I don't know. I'm sure Fincher, probably this is his one shot at it, really. I don't think he's a director who's going to become too wedded to a franchise. You know, it's over 2.5 hours, but it didn't feel like that at all. I don't think that there's a flat bit in this film.
All lots of snow around, very cold. Mm-hmm. Is it Christmassy, though?
It's the blackest Christmas you're ever going to experience, I think, this film.
Thank you to Zan. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. For the best film reviews and news over the festive period, go to the best film site on the web, guardian.co.uk/film. At actress Michelle Yeoh is probably the biggest female star in Chinese cinema, following breakout success in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and her brilliant turn as one of the best ever Bond girls opposite Pierce Brosnan in Tomorrow Never Dies in 1997, of course. She can out-stunt Jackie Chan and has appeared in English language titles as diverse as Kung Fu Panda 2 and Asif Kapadia's Far North. She now takes on her most politically charged role in The Lady, playing Aung San Suu Kyi, the Burmese leader kept under house arrest by a military regime which refused to budge. Directed by Luc Besson, it forms another of his surprise studies of powerful women such as La Femme Nikita and Joan of Arc, and he laces it with domestic scenes, bringing the personal to the political.
Be good, won't you? Help Daddy around the house. It will be hard for me to get to a phone, so don't worry if it's a while before you hear from me.
How long are you going to be away?
A week. Maybe two.
Right, that's it. Come on, come on. We're very late. Come on, rush.
I began by asking Michelle how she played someone both in the public eye, yet hidden from view.
You know, it's nothing worse than trying to impersonate someone, because especially who Dorsu is and what she represents, you feel that to do her justice, you have to truly understand and step into those shoes. Mm. I think it helped really a lot when because Luc Besson had about 300 refugees, Burmese refugees, which he cast for the film from the northern part of Thailand and brought them down. And when they gave that integrity, you know, that sort of real honesty to the film. And when I, every day I remember when I walked through the gates and when they saw me, I could see in their eyes, they didn't see me, they saw Dorsu. Mm-hmm. And it really helps, you know, it gets you right away. And because you know it so well, it was a very emotional ride. Because in the film, it's the 10 years of her life, and we did it in like 2 months. Mm-hmm. So it was very, very intense. Yeah.
There's a lot of scenes as well, which I think must be similar to you. You're a long-distance actress. You know, you're all over the world at various different times. Mm-hmm. That picking up the phone and talking to family. Yeah. It seemed to me, I don't know why, watching you, it felt very, that you must know that.
That you understand. I think, you know, maybe it's because I'm a Buddhist as a woman. I don't have children, but I can understand, you know, that being cut off from your family because constantly I'm away from home. Mm. So I'm not able to see my parents or my nieces and nephews. And then when you talk on the phone, there's only so much you can say. And, you know, there's not enough time to do everything. So you always understand that distance. But I also understood when you love someone, it's not about seeing them every day. Yes, of course, you'd love to be with them. But to have that bond in your heart that you can pick up from exactly where you left off. Mm. And, you know, that distance doesn't make it worse, you know, the heart, it does sometimes make the heart grow fonder. Mm-hmm. And then the most important thing is that when you are able to get together is to appreciate, you know, what you have.
Yeah. And there's a lot of that in the film, this film. It is a film of comings and goings and emotions. Correct. And kind of, you know, tensions and releases.
That's
it's about
right.
That.
You're absolutely right. Because, you know, over the years she was under house arrest and the family were not allowed to come and see her because that was the easiest way for the regime at that time. You know, when you cut off the roots, which are her family, the tree will fall.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I break your spirit, you either go crazy or you will run away. You know, and she was, think about it, like Mandela was under lock and key. He was in jail. Mm. And her, she was in the house arrest, but if she just said, okay, I need to go and see my family, the regime would have given her the plane, you know, to leave. Mm. But they would never let her come back again.
And that would be the end of her movement. They would have no figurehead, presumably.
Yeah, but you know, she always said she has to be with her people. It's like when people go to war, we understand what it is, because when you are there for that reason, and at the end of the day, that reason becomes bigger than you, bigger than everything else.
The strength of duty, I think, which is a concept. Sort of, I don't know if I'm familiar with duty. You know, as a young man, if I were a young man and this was 100 years ago, I would be at war in the trenches. Mm-hmm. In the First World War. Mm-hmm. Even the Second World War.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
A duty that, please God, I never really have
so
to know that. Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, then you end up talking to acting with 300 Burmese refugees who must know that.
You know, when we were there, when you're with them, I think it was a very bold move on Luke's part to cast. They're not actors, but you know that they are so full of emotions. And if you're a good director, all you do is you press that, mm-hmm. and those emotions come out automatically. And I think what Luke did for me was incredible, was because the first scene that we shot was in the hospital. And because it brings you right there when you see the way the army was treating the students and all that. And I saw them at rehearsal, and I knew that these people were just doing it for the first time. There was no stunt coordinator that choreographed every move and said, okay, whack, whack, and you know, you block. They just came in, and the way they were, it was really reliving. You know, and one of them turned around, who's a carpenter by profession, and Luke said to him, oh, do you know how they behave? He says, yeah, half my family were killed by them. So, you know, it's like you watch them. And for me as an actor, when you're faced with something like this, suddenly you realize, I know where that woman had to go, you know, and because of that, you know, yes, she is a mother of two, and then the next day she became mother of a nation, and all of these people or children need, you know, and you can make a difference. It's almost like, oh, okay.
It's a hell of a story to sort of pack in as well. That to contrast the mother of two in a housewife to the woman, the mother of a nation, as you say. And I think the film does it really well. Kind of the contrast is really good between the domesticity and the kind of major thing. I wonder, when you talk about exile, and I sometimes think actors might feel on set like they're under house arrest. You know, I know it's a rather comfier version of it, but you know, being away from home, etc. Who are your people, Michelle? Who do you feel are your people now?
Who are my people? You know, I've been really lucky in the sense that everywhere I've gone, I've met and gotten to know a lot of people, you know, like living in Hong Kong, you know, a single girl going there at such a young age. And now I have like a second family, you know, I have got children there. I have, you know, sisters, you know, women we've become so close. They're like my sisters. So, and in a sense, now I'm spending more time in Europe. I think the most important thing is it's about how you open up to people. Because if you welcome them into your lives, you find that they will welcome you into theirs. And I think for me, I feel I will always be Malaysian in heart and, you know, on paper. But I do sometimes feel like a citizen of the world.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I mentioned Far North, because you were playing, I don't know what,
reindeer
Inuit.
Herder, yes. Up in Norway. And that was an incredible experience. Yeah. That's the beauty about being in the film business, because, you know, we walk in and out of lives and characters. When it's a fictional character, I mean, you have the liberty to, you know, let your imagination run wild. But here, playing Dorsu, you suddenly feel a different sense of challenge, because, you know, you're talking about someone who's very much alive. And at that time when we started, we couldn't get access to her. We couldn't say, oh, is this right? Mm-hmm. Is this real? You know, and if you think about it, family members hadn't seen her. Kim was the last one to see her after the father died. And other family members hadn't seen her since 1988. You know, friends hadn't seen her for so long. I mean, it's asking you, do you remember what you were doing last year, you know, with so-and-so? You know, your own memory starts playing tricks on you. Yeah. So it was an interesting journey, I think, for David Thewlis and myself when we spoke with old friends, family members. Yeah. And for David, it was even more challenging because he had to play Michael Aris and the twin, you know.
I know. That was a big surprise. I didn't know that. I was watching the film and I always did him again. Brilliant. Yes. I think he's brilliant, David Thewlis, I have to say.
Completely. I mean, he's a chameleon. The biggest problem for David is because nobody recognizes him in the roles because he doesn't look like David Thewlis.
Congratulations on the report. It's lovely to have you back on Film Weekly. Yeah. Please be in some more films and come back.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to Michelle Yeoh. The Lady is out here in the UK from Friday the 30th of December, and I rather liked it. Thewlis is great in it too. That's all for this week. The music we've been featuring on the show is the wonderful score to The Artist, which won the European Film Academy Award ahead of people like Alexandre Desplat. It's by Ludovic Bors, and it is absolutely divine. Next week, myself and Zan will be revealing our top 10 films of the year. We want to hear your top 3. Don't forget, email them to us, film.weekly@guardian.co.uk, or post them to us via Twitter, @filmweekly, that's us. If you do, you're in the hat and have a chance of winning a year's membership to the Picture House Cinemas. It's a UK-only competition, I'm afraid, but well worth entering anyway. We want to know your top three films. Next week, Zan and I will tell you ours. For now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.